So it's my dad's judo shodan and black belt certificate from the Kodokan in Japan.
I got four of them.
Four?
Yeah, but I never sent in the money to get the ones for fifth, sixth, yeah. seventh, and eighth.
Right.
But, yeah.
It's nice,
the,
right?
Yeah, that's the real deal.
Yeah. And he gave me his other ones as well. But this guy, Rolando or something in New York, he was his first judo teacher. And then I think by the time he was brown, he went to Mr. Sheena. And Mr. Sheena kind of like groomed him after Brown to then go to Japan. But did you know Mr. Sheena? Were you like...
Absolutely.
Like, what was your first memory of Mr. Sheena? Just because I've known Mr. Sheena my whole life.
So yeah, like, he came from Japan.
Yeah.
From Nihon University with UNESCO from Jersey.
Right.
And both of them made ninth degree red belt, but right. UNESCO passed on a few years ago.
Yeah.
UNESCO was, I think, a two-time Olympic coach, and he endorsed my judo mate.
Right.
And his son now, who was a national champion, he inherited UNESCO's dojo where he owned the building.
Right.
So Nick UNESCO has Cranford Judo and Karate.
Oh, wow.
And so... Sheena was in the New York Judo Association, which I was in. And his techniques were devastating, right and left side.
And he is a small
man.
Yeah,
he was like
right?
a middleweight
right.
little guy. I see him. I saw him last at the New York Athletic Club, the New York Open, where we go every year around the beginning of March.
I can remember being young. And going over Mr. Sheena's house, playing with his son.
Yeah.
And so it's always interesting. Tell me about, is it Jerome Mackey who brought everybody over? Is that who
yes.
brought it?
Yes, Jerome Mackey had three dojos. During that time, I had my dojo in Mid Island Plaza in Hicksville. And he had one in Manhattan, one in Hempstead, and one in Brooklyn. So he brought over Sheena, UNESCO, a few others, even Yamashita.
Right.
And they thought they were going to strike it rich here. He was paying them $150 a week at that time.
Right.
And they couldn't survive.
Right.
They were all living in one apartment.
And what year is this?
This had to be around...
50s?
No, early 60s.
Early 60s.
I came back from Japan in October of 63.
So just to set the stage, because some people might not know about judo. So like late 60s, some of the best martial artists, judo practitioners in the world come over to America, but nobody really knows what's going on, and they're all living together?
Well, yeah, they had several of them were in the same apartment.
Wow.
Then he had them on a contract. Mackey's was like a real commercial dojo.
Yeah.
You signed up there $1,000.
Wow. Even back then, that's...
No,
that's
listen, you signed up there for $1,000 and you were a member until you made black belt.
Okay.
Then he had Miyazaki, another Shotokan master, who I knew his sensei in Japan, Mr. Okano, teaching the karate.
Wow.
And he would tell Miyazaki, work them hard, because he was signing them up so fast, the place wasn't big enough to facilitate them.
Wow.
So he expected them to drop out.
Yeah.
So then they had each of them, Yamashita, I know, and UNESCO, signed a 5-year contract that they couldn't teach in a dojo 5 miles within any one of his locations. So, no, 25 miles.
Whoa, 25.
Yeah, so if you're in Manhattan and you're in Hempstead and you're Brooklyn.
Yeah.
you were out of it.
Yeah.
So UNESCO went to Cranford, New Jersey.
Wow.
So when I came back from Japan, I met this guy at the Kodokan. His name was George Kerr. Today, he's a 10th Dan. I didn't know who he was then.
An American guy?
No, he's from UK.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's got to be rare, a 10th.
Yeah, he recently made 10th Dan.
Wow.
And so I met him in the foreign student dojo at the Kodokan. And he asked me where I was from. I said, New York. He says, have you done judo in New York? I says, no. He says, well, I just passed through New York on my way here, and I stopped at the Buddhist Academy on Riverside Drive, American Buddhist Academy. It was a dojo underneath a Buddhist temple.
Huh.
And he said there was a sixth Dan there and a fifth Dan. So I joined there, and it was good. But there wasn't much competition for me. I was like a 21-year-old second-degree black belt with 3.5 years of intensive training in Japan, 62-63 USF Force Judo team, representing them in national competition in 62-63. And then Yamashita opened up in Astoria. And he opened up like a week before his contract expired.
Oh.
And he had a really nice big dojo. Yeah. And there was 5 fifth Dans there from Waseda University. So I was going down there 3 times a week, banging heads with those guys. In 7 years, I've thrown every one of them.
Wow. Just for those of you who maybe don't know this, Dan, when we refer to like Dan, that's the degree of black belt. You might say fifth Dan.
Dan. First Dan, second first Dan. Dan.
Right, and the highest would be 10. So that's just, so we're talking about like high level people when you're talking about like a fifth Dan black belt in judo.
Yeah, so I'm one of the very few Americans that attained that level.
Right. And right now you're an eighth.
Eighth, yeah.
Yeah.
Which allows me to wear a red and white belt.
Right.
So I've been in judo. I joined the Air Force at 17.
17. Isn't that young? That's...
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, they took me in at 17.
Oh, wow.
And I went to basic training in jet fighter school. And after that, the first 5 months... I got orders stationing me in Japan.
Huh.
And then I was working, I was training with the base boxing team in the morning and at night. And I was working on the flight line, learning to send planes off, strap pilot, jet pilots in the planes. And so I was working with this Japanese-American staff sergeant. He asked me what I was doing with myself. I told him I was doing boxing. He says, what are you doing that? He goes, that's not going to take you anywhere. He says, you should go to judo. And he draws this map outside the base into another town. And so I procrastinated for a week or so. Every time I ran into him, did you go yet? You know, it was like that.
Did he practice judo himself?
No. So then... I always had kept the paper on me in the direction. And then I had to walk about 2 miles outside the base, and the sensei had a dojo attached to his house.
What was his name?
Matsunaga.
Matsunaga.
He was a fifth Dan, a little lightweight.
Yeah.
And he had about 15 first-degree black belts in there, and right. Some second degrees that were like 18, 19, and I was like 160 pounds.
Yeah.
That was their size.
Yeah.
And I was going every night for 3 hours.
Wow.
And then they taught me how to break fall. Then they started free fighting with me called Randori.
Yeah.
And They're foot sweeping me. I'm flying through the air. I get up. Boom. I remember getting thrown all over the place. And I was a tough kid. Yeah. And I came out of Brooklyn when I was a kid.
What part of Brooklyn?
Ridgewood.
Okay.
All right. So I was of the nature that I was getting excited. I was going, if they can do this to me that easy, I'm staying.
Right.
Most GIs would come. They wouldn't last a week. Their ego,
the ego couldn't take it.
Right? So it was like 1,800 yen for a judo gi and 1,800 yen a month, which was $5.
$5. You know how much the judo gis cost now?
Yeah.
They're like $200 almost for some of the good ones.
Yeah. And but when I was in Japan, during my time there, was 360 yen to a dollar.
Wow.
So, you know, we were living pretty good on GI pay. I rented a room in a single family house with my girlfriend. So I had a residence on base in the barracks and had my own apartment.
So a month of training was 5 yen also?
$5 a month.
Amazing.
1,800 yen a month.
Yeah, 1,800, okay.
Now that same sensei taught at Yokota Air Base. There was a dojo on base with GIs. Okay.
Yeah.
But I never started with them. I learned from the Japanese black belts, and my game was better and faster.
Three hours a night, too.
Yeah, every night. So what happened was...
But in the beginning, like, when you're getting thrown, and you're like, sometimes I wonder this about myself with martial arts, like, how did I get past the awkward stage, like, where you're not really executing properly? Like, I'm almost surprised that I was able to stick it out.
Well, that's the whole thing, you see. A black belt is someone who never quit.
Right.
So then... I used to have my toes jammed, my toes were purple. I used to limp back to the base at night.
Yeah.
And after a couple of months, I still didn't know. After a couple of months, I still didn't even know that judo was a world sport. Right. It got introduced into the Olympics in 1964 in Tokyo.
And what year is this that you're beginning training?
1960.
1960, okay.
Yeah. So then, I kind of got accepted in the dojo because after the workout, you slid open the door and you went into a tea room with a low table.
Yeah.
And four or five of the black belts would be in there. So then they send out for sushi. It was the same way we would send out for a pizza.
Yeah, yeah.
So a guy would deliver the trays, the tray on a bicycle.
Wow.
So that was my first introduction to raw fish and what have you. So they were eating it. I ate it.
Mr. Sheena has the same thing he did in his basement after training.
Yeah, go down there. It's customary. So now this Japanese guy, I used to see him come in, and the black belts hung their gis on a special thing in the ceiling and let them dry out after each workout.
Right.
You know, they put it on a pole and hang it up on the ceiling. So I'm sitting there, and this guy turns around to me and in perfect English goes, "What squadron are you in?" I go, "You're a GI." He goes, "Yeah, I'm in the 56th Weather Squadron." I says, "Holy, you know, I've seen him in there for 2 months. He never said a word to me."
Yeah.
So then... he told me that to come up to the base gym because this guy Miyazaki was coming. He was an Air Force champion. He just got stationed at Yokota. He was a third dan. So we went up there and we were working out with him, and he was tossing us all over the place, a middleweight technician. And he was personal friends with one of the great teachers from the Kodokan and Tokyo University, Tadao Otaki.
Oh, that's your sensei.
Yeah. He's got books out with Don Draeger. And we all kicked in. I think at that time then we kicked in, I don't know, $25 a month.
Right.
He came twice a week. 1.5 hours each way. Whoa. Out of Tokyo.
Really?
Yeah. And once a week, he brought one of his fourth or fifth dance from the university. And we knew we were in for a beat. But, you know, we used to get slammed around, but they taught us.
Yeah.
And then I was still going to the Japanese dojo in town. And then we started training. I started staying up at the base because we trained 5 nights a week at the base gym dojo. Two of those nights, Professor Otake came and gave us stuff to work with.
And what was Otake, what was his rank?
At that time, he was an eighth dan, and he was...
Eighth dan? How old was he?
Probably in his middle 50s.
Did you ever do randori with him?
A little bit, but I was just a 160-pound kid.
Yeah.
But what I learned from him was moving entries into all the major throws.
Yeah.
And original form. He guided like 7 All Japan champions.
Wow.
And he was a professor of physical education at Tokyo University, plus a senior sensei at the Kodokan.
Wow.
Plus he was very close with Kotani sensei, who became a 10th dan. And Kotani was an original student of Kano, Jigoro Kano.
And Jigoro Kano was the founder of judo.
Yeah, so Professor Otake said that he took lessons from Professor Okano too, but he was a kid, yeah. And Okano was very old.
Yeah.
So a year later, I went down to the dojo in town, and I started slamming all them black belts that used to toss me around.
Because really?
I had a better quality of judo, better posture, better right. entries. And then...
all from those moving entries. Because the throws...
Just the stuff I'm teaching you.
Right. But the throws themselves, I often wonder this, because I look at books and things like that on judo, and I'm looking at the throws, and I'm like, all the books are saying very similar things, you know, and I talk to my dad, and it's like everybody... But what made Otake different than your other sensei?
Because he had the original form and timing and moving. When you look at judo books, the pictures are static.
Yeah.
The best book out is Best Judo by Inokuma and Sato.
Okay.
Those are two of his students.
Yeah.
Inokuma and Sato produced the great Yasuhiro Yamashita. 205 matches undefeated, 4 world titles, All Japan champion 9 times,
wow.
Olympic gold. And I attended a clinic that Yamashita did in New York. And watching him do the moving techniques transported my mind back to Professor Otake.
Really?
So I was able to get a picture with him, and I told him who my sensei was, and he knew him.
Wow.
But Otake was already gone. But another interesting thing happened to me was I won the Far East Air Force Championship, 62 and 63, and I got 2 free trips back to the States to try out for the Air Force team, which I took a silver medal each time.
Right.
Then trained for 10 days, one time with Nakabayashi, who migrated to New York.
He wrote a book, right?
Nakabayashi, yeah. And in 63, I flew back with Professor Kotani.
Wow.
And Nelson Cross, the big heavyweight, who was a student of Nakabayashi. So we landed on Wake Island.
Where's that?
In the middle of the Pacific. There was a big war there.
Right.
The U.S. had a battle for it. So they had to wait for the plane needed a part.
Right.
And so we had like a 6-hour layover. So we're walking on this beach, and the water was totally like aqua. It was magnificent.
Yeah.
And we're hanging on every word of Kotani. You know, U.S. Judo Association printed the article. I wrote the story.
Huh. How old is Kotani at this point?
Maybe 70s.
Wow.
And
so a real master.
Yeah. So listen. So now We walked past two rusted out U.S. troop attack boats. Half of them were stuck in the sand.
Wow.
And we passed it. We didn't say anything. It was just so surrealistic.
Yeah.
Like 15, 16 years earlier, we were at war with them.
Yeah.
And so Kotani knew that I was Otaki's student. So every Saturday, I spent the whole day at the Kodokan.
Right.
So before I went, I was when I won the first Far East Air Force Championship, I was a first-degree brown belt, and I was throwing black belts. Bases from three bases in Korea, Okinawa, the Philippines, three bases in Japan,
yeah,
right? The whole Pacific Rim. It was a slam-banged-out tournament.
Yeah.
And all the officials from the Kodokan came to the base gym where we had the tournament.
Right.
So then they arranged for me to take a special test for black belt in the foreign student dojo at the Kodokan on a Saturday. And I went up there, and it was like guys from Europe testing, several countries in Europe. They come to Japan to try to fight in the red and white tournament.
Right.
When it stays up, so they accumulate points and they can go up a grade.
Right.
So, so I was sitting there, and then they give me a knowledge test. Show me this throw, that throw. Show me this, show me that. Then I had to do 9 throws from the kata, moving techniques with a partner. So then I performed all that. And then Kotani comes over to me, and he goes, Joe, he says, start loosening up now, Shiai. Now you got to fight somebody. So they pick some middleweight. First stand off the big floor. You got 500 guys out there.
Yeah.
Right? This guy comes in dripping in sweat. And there's a table with like 4 or 5 red and white belts sitting there.
Judging.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I threw the guy twice with Uchimata and a die throw, and they stopped it. And then I got awarded to first black.
So they just give it to you right there on the spot.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting to look back on this and like the mind, I mean, your mind right now is totally different than the mind of a...
Well, absolutely. You know, the judo, then I competed 12 years in national competition.
12 years.
7 times a Med AAU champion.
Yeah.
Runner-up in the Eastern Olympic Trials.
So a runner-up in the Eastern Olympic Trials. So like... So the Olympic trials. So you were close.
Yeah.
To the Olympics. To the Olympic level. Could have been. Could have been.
But in my case.
Yeah.
Before I left Japan, I got accepted to be a Kensushi student at the Kodokan.
What is this?
A Kensushi student is a special research student.
Okay.
Jim Bregman.
Yeah.
He was a Kensushi.
Okay.
And Ben Campbell, they were there training for the Olympics when I was there learning my basics.
Right.
So I was supposed to go back to Japan for 4 more years of training because I got out. I was 21, second degree black belt.
Yeah.
That would have put me on a world stage.
Yeah.
But this and that happened, and a marriage happened, and a pregnancy happened, and
life happened.
So I took what I got, what I had, and I honed my skills at Waseda Club.
Yeah.
Fighting these fifth-degree black belts from Waseda University.
Right. In Queens.
Yeah, in Astoria.
Astoria, yeah.
Yeah. And guys would visit. These are three-hour nonstop workouts.
Three hours of straight randori.
Not just randori.
Oh, okay.
Mat work.
Right.
Uchikomi, fit-ins, yeah. Drills. Randori, and guys that visited us, they were shot after our warm-up.
Yeah.
So looking back now, I was in the right place at the right time at the right age. I trained with George Harris on the U.S. Air Force judo team. He was like the Muhammad Ali of judo.
Right.
Right, and also Tosh Seno, who became my mentor.
Right.
I finished second to him. He was already a national champion. And I'm friends with him to this day. When I go out to California, I visit him at his home.
Yeah.
Legend. So he taught me my Hanigoshi left foot entry.
Wow.
And I honed it with my sensei.
Yeah.
When I was fortunate to get two free trips to go back and forth from Japan.
So you went back.
Yeah, I came in 62. I was already away from home for 2 years. And I fought on the Air Force judo team. I took fourth in the nationals that year.
Right.
In the 160s.
Right.
Then I took a 30-day leave home. I wasn't home for 2 years.
Hold on one sec, Joe. Could you just turn that down just because I don't want that to pick it up?
Okay.
Sorry. Cool. I don't want that.
Yeah, so then... So that was a nice break. Then I went back to Japan and continued training. So after I made first degree black belt, I entered the monthly contest called the Red and White Tournament.
No, Red and White, why?
What's the name? They have 60 entries. So they make a red team and a white team, and they oppose each other.
Oh, okay.
And then you have your name written in Japanese on this big chart, and then below you, who you're supposed to fight. But I never knew who I was supposed to fight, but they knew who I was because I was a foreigner.
Right.
So my coach, Miyazaki, puts it in my head, you got to get 5 in a row, Batsugan.
5 in a row?
Yeah, he told me, I got to get 5 in a row. I can go to second dan right on the spot if I throw 5 in a row without a rest.
Now, is that for any rank?
Yeah.
If you throw 5, you go up a grade.
Yeah.
Wow.
Jim Bregman threw 6 third dans in a row. I was there. I watched it.
Wow.
So, my first tournament, I throw 3 in a row. And I drew with the 4th one, so I had to sit down.
Yeah.
So that Monday night, these are on Saturdays when I go to the Kodokan. So that Monday night, I go back to the dojo, right? And Miyazaki says, how'd you do? I says, I only got 3. He says, oh, he went crazy. Got 3. It's unbelievable. I go, well, how many did you get the first time you won? He says, oh, I got thrown. You know, it's like telling a fighter it's the wrong round.
Right.
So the second month, I got another 3.
Wow.
So now they put me up in the middle of the line.
Right.
Where guys would with points. So then I would get 1-1. Ultimately, I accumulated 13 full point wins and 13 points in 7 months.
And how many points do you need to go up a rank?
10.
10.
And a year time and grade.
Okay.
So I went up and took another test. And I got promoted to second dan.
So could one feasibly, let's take it to the extreme, could one feasibly go to a 10th degree by the time they're 40?
No, not that way.
Not that way. So at a certain point...
Technically, the skill levels are 4th and 5th degree black belt.
Right.
If you notice on that Shodan certificate you just showed me, it says, we expect him to endeavor for further progress in the future.
Oh.
But when you get the 4th Dan certificate, we expect them to be an expert leader in the future.
Oh, really?
So 4th Dan is a sensei rank.
Right.
Yeah, so I got 4th Dan and whatever, like that. And
then, wow.
I made 5th Dan at 30 years old. I trained.
You were 5th at 30?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I trained down in... I lived in Dallas-Fort Worth for 10 years. I was used to sell loose diamonds in 4 states. And I was assistant instructor at Tomura Judo Institute. Vince Tomura, who was a 3-time national champion.
Wow.
And he put me in for 5th.
See, I don't think a lot of people know this. Even that practice Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I don't think they understand that Jigoro Kano was, he was very into education. He was an educator.
Yeah, see, so Jigoro Kano was professor of physical education at Tokyo University,
right.
The same position that my sensei held.
Oh, wow.
Tokyo University was like a very high, you know, I don't know what you could compare it to here. Yeah. Maybe like, maybe it could be like a Harvard.
Right.
Because my sensei says that his students go on to win titles after they get out.
Yeah.
It wasn't a university where you pass because you were a judo champion.
Right.
You had to keep your grades.
Yeah.
Standard.
Yeah.
So Inokuma came out of there, Sato, both old Japan champions.
Sure.
Inokuma was Olympic champion. And then they hooked up at Tokai University and developed Yamashita.
Wow. I just read a biography on Kano, and one of the things that I read that I really loved, he said, I didn't create judo to make it a win-at-any-cost sport.
Right.
He said, I created it so one could analyze their inner self when they lose, to like look at your character and build character.
That was his primary objective.
Amazing.
To uplift humanity that way, using the art, not seeking trophies, but, you know, in the 30s, he did introduce judo to the Olympic Committee.
Yeah.
And he took Professor Kotani with him to Europe, and Kotani was wailing on everybody, these right. big Europeans. In fact, Kano passed away on his return, on a boat on his return to Japan with pneumonia. Wow.
But I also know the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu community has no idea that judo is the real grandfather of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah, you could say that, because Jigoro Kano mastered three leading combat Jiu-Jitsu systems at that time, in that era. One was noted for strangling.
Yeah.
Another was noted for their arm bars.
Right.
Another was noted for their throwing techniques. And he became, that's how he rented a small room at the Ajoji temple, Buddhist temple, where they started. But the top practitioners in those jiu-jitsu system became his students.
Yeah.
So there was this famous battle that took place. 15 of Kodokan judo guys, and some of them were from the combat jiu-jitsu schools.
Yeah.
This is before Helio Gracie developed his ground game jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And Kodokan won 14-1.
Yeah.
They lost one match.
It's amazing.
Then Kodokan judo started flourishing.
Right.
Because, see, he took out the dangerous throws to take falls from.
Right.
From the combat jiu-jitsu systems.
Yeah.
And perfected the art of yukimi, breakfalling. So if you want to get skillful in judo, a good sensei will make sure that you master the art of breakfalling.
Yeah.
So when you group up with somebody, your just intention is to throw them. Not stiff arm them and run and hide so you don't get thrown.
Right.
Those guys never become throwers.
Yeah. I was going through that with Seamus. We were doing Randori, and I could tell he was scared to get thrown. And I said, Seamus, you know how to break fall. And I just said, let me throw you a few times.
Yes, that was perfect.
And I threw him very gentle. But then I started throwing him a little harder, but he was break falling proper then. And it was a thing of, okay, and especially to see it in his eyes light up of him kind of becoming a man and trying to understand
yeah.
where his grit is.
You know? I asked him at the last class, I says, are you liking judo? He goes, he looks at me, he goes, I love it.
Okay.
So it's wonderful that we can, I can pass some techniques to you.
Yeah.
You know, the bottom line is this. When I was a kid in Japan, you need to have one, to make black belt, you needed to have one or two good throws, one or two good arm locks, one or two good strangles, one or two good pins. Because in judo, you could pin somebody for 30 seconds. Right. Now it's 25 seconds. They keep changing it. But it keeps it live. It keeps it real.
Yeah.
So if you want to be a black belt, go and start throwing first-degree black belts.
Right.
You know, I watch matches in the foreign student dojos. A guy comes from Italy, fights a fourth-degree black belt.
Yeah.
And I seen this guy throw him.
Right.
So, but one of the things that impressed me on the ground floor of the Kodokan, there's several dojos along the walk.
Yeah.
In the window. So you see the white-haired, red and white belts teaching the kids.
That's amazing.
So that impressed me at that time. I said, this could be a lifelong thing. Because the old red and white belts are teaching the moving techniques to the children. As they get up into college or high school level, their senseis would be a young fourth or fifth dan. If they get into a college, they're right. going to get under a high-ranked professor. And so Professor Otake says, when these first and second dans come to my college,
yeah.
4 years of college training, he says, then we teach them real judo. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they already got the foundation.
Right. And a red and white belt, is anybody above six?
Six, seven, and eight is red.
Six,
and
seven, and eight.
Yeah.
What's nine?
Solid red. And 10 is solid red.
Okay.
So before UNESCO passed, UNESCO made 9, Sheena made 9, then Matsumura, who came from a different university, he recently made 9.
Oh, he's 14 at the 14th Street with the YMCA, Matsumura, right?
I think he teaches there, and he taught for years at the New York AC.
Right.
And his top student is Tamok Johnson Ono.
Right.
Who's an Olympian national champion. And when I came back from Japan and joined the Buddhist Academy, Tamok was 7 years old.
Yeah.
So I was at the Buddhist Academy when Matsumura came.
Wow.
But I think I should have stayed there and studied under Matsumura. I went where the action was.
Yeah.
To Waseda.
Right, because there were more high-ranking people there.
Yeah, and there was more black belts, and I had more of a... But I never, in my 7 years fighting in New York, I never visited any dojos.
Yeah.
Somebody wanted to try me out, they came down there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't want to give nobody my game away.
Right.
Because every year, you know, I won several times as a middleweight and then as a light heavy, under 205, under 209. And fighting these shrunking heavyweights, guys that are 6'1", 6'2", they get in under 209.
Do you feel that judo has changed the way you think about problems, just in general in life?
Yeah, because what it did was it tempered my emotions. I've always had good control over anger.
Yeah.
Emotion.
Yeah.
You fight in a contest, you got to suck it up.
Right.
You know, if you're a boxer and you get hit in the face, you can't get angry and go crazy. You'll get knocked out.
Right.
So from there, I retired when I was 30 years old from active competition. But then, at 38 years old, I was living in Texas. I entered the senior division of the Southwest Open, and I took first.
Wow.
And Chicago was very tough. I was blasting those guys from Chicago, and they brought a ringer with them, this third dan from Britain. And he was tossing everybody. And he put a grip on me. He was about 6'2". I couldn't even see his left leg.
He was so far back.
And he would bait and put his right foot forward.
Right.
Thinking if someone tried Osoto, he would reverse it and throw them.
With her eye.
Yeah. So a sensei at the Kodokan taught me this entry into Osoto Gary. Right. I showed it to you.
Yeah.
You step with your left foot right in line with his right toe. You don't go in alongside. And I blasted in on him with a ki-ai. That means a bonsai 100% commitment. And slammed him. There's dust still coming off of the mad way he hit. That was one of my really nice wins.
Yeah.
Certain guys that I recall, they were tough matches when you going up against someone, another fourth Dan, then you know he's capable of throwing you too.
Yeah.
So that's what keeps it real.
Yeah.
You know. So I got maybe 12 good wins against some really good champions.
That's great. And then you opened up, did you have a dojo in Texas?
No.
No dojo.
Because I traveled.
So when you moved back from Texas, you opened your dojo.
No, let me see. No. That was after when I went back down, when I went to Texas.
Oh, so you opened your dojo before
Texas. I opened the dojo in Hicksville.
Right.
In a shopping center. It used to be a Vic Tanny gym, two floors. Downstairs I had steam. There was a built-in steam room, four showers. I put in a 6x12 sauna. Upstairs where they had all the weights, mirrored walls, carpeted, I put in a 20x80 mat.
Nice.
And these owners of the shopping center, they didn't know where. What are you going to put in there? Because the place was closed for 2 years.
Yeah.
I said, judo. Right? What's judo? Blah, blah, blah. They rent me the place in 1965 for $475 a month rent on a month-to-month lease. I built it up to 200 students.
200 students?
Yeah, that's I had 100 kids in it on Saturday, four classes of kids, 25, 30 in each class. I brought Shotokan karate to Long Island, and I had a friend of mine teaching Aikido.
Wow.
Then people would come in during the day. I'd give them a towel and a lock, and they'd go downstairs and use the facility for like $3.
So what? I mean, as a business owner, I'm so interested in this, in that, you know, everything's going successful. But when did you close it? What was that? Because I always think about that. I think.
No, what happened was Mid-Island Shopping Plaza got sold.
Okay.
Now the new owners wanted to get serious with me. They wanted to jack my rent to close to $3,000 a month.
Ridiculous. High
retail. Yeah. So what I did was I found a dojo in a town on Woodbury Road, 20 feet wide, 80 feet deep with no post, for $275 a month.
Perfect.
So I sold my sauna to somebody for what I paid for it, a couple of grand.
Yeah.
I took my mats and took my sign. And I was on a month-to-month lease and took all my students to the dojo in town.
Yeah.
So 3 years later, I sold it to my Shotokan karate instructor.
Ah.
Then I went out to San Diego.
So you sold the business?
Yeah.
So it wasn't a choice to, like, I'm going to close it. It was,
Yeah, so I sold the business.
But that's hard. You got a lot of people under you.
Yeah, it was hard to do.
Yeah.
But one of my top students stayed there for 25 years.
Oh, he taught the judo for you, so you left him in good hands.
Yeah, and Mike Hatches built it up. He studied under Miyazaki in the city.
Right.
Shotokan master. So now my brother just comes back from Vietnam. I went through a divorce, and we were camping out at my mom's house that Christmas, and then we got an apartment in Westbury, high-end apartment, swimming pool, all that. And that's when I pursued the mystic path.
Right.
I wanted answers. So my father studied for 17 years under an ex-Roman Catholic priest who was a Rosicrucian mystic. He left the Vatican.
Wow.
And he resided in Brooklyn. And due to the illness of my grandfather at 42 years old, he had a reputation in the neighborhood that he was a healer. So through the Italian grapevine, he came and visited my grandfather. My grandfather was too far gone, and he said he couldn't help him.
Yeah.
And my grandfather passed and left 8 kids.
Wow.
And all the Italians in Brooklyn at that time, they had ice businesses.
Ice.
I remember them delivering ice up to my apartment. The guy comes up with ice on his shoulder and puts a chunk of ice in the ice box. And he's got a horse and wagon outside.
Filled with ice.
Yeah. So my father became a student of the Father Artali.
Yeah.
And he used to give my father books from the Theosophical Society, Rosicrucian books, and that was my father's pride and joy.
Yeah.
So then I went and got the books, and then I had time on my hands. I had some money.
Right.
And then I saw where they were purchased at Samuel Weiser Bookstore in Manhattan. It was there for 100 years. There was the most prolific, mystic, metaphysical bookstore in the world.
Huh.
They published books by Roman Catholic priests who used to talk about their out-of-the-body experience in the astral world.
Wow.
Under different names.
Right.
So the church wouldn't imprison them.
Wow.
So I used to go there. I used to sit on the floor and go through Sufi books, Buddha Sutra books, mystic... Right. Mulana Rumi, the Sufi masters.
Yeah.
One book led me to another book, which led me to another book, and I came across a book called The Path of the Masters by Dr. Julian Johnson. And I bought that book.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing how one book can change your entire
life? Change your life a lot. I read this book. I used to fall, it was about 3 or 4 inches thick. I used to fall asleep reading it, wake up reading it.
Yeah.
2 or 3 days. It tied everything in.
What was the name of the book?
Path of the Masters by Dr. Julian Johnson. And he owned a hospital in L.A. He was a surgeon. And he was visiting a colleague's widow, lifelong friend. So he visited her for a few days, and she had a book by Salwan Singh about Surat Shabd Yoga. She didn't say nothing to him.
Yeah.
He pursued her. Where did you get this? She says, well, he's a master in India. She's been reading his books. One thing led to another. He writes a letter to Salwan Singh and asks permission to come to India. He sells the hospital, and he spent the last 7 years of his life at the feet of Salwan Singh in India, working in the free hospital. And during that time, he wrote The Path of the Masters.
Oh, okay.
And at that time, my guru was the successor of Salwan Singh, Kirpal Singh.
Okay.
So then... One morning, a friend of mine comes banging on the door, you know. Look at this, a little ad in a penny saver. Divine Science of the Soul, Surat Shabd Yoga at St. Christopher's Episcopal Church. Just on the other side of Hempstead Turnpike on Hicksville Road.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of paths going around at that time, 70, 71.
Yeah.
And I was looking at them. Transcendental Meditation was charging $125 for some technique.
Mm-hmm.
They sold thousands and thousands. Today it's up to $1,400.
Wow.
And I figured that if an Episcopal church lets this group meditate there, this can't be some off-the-wall pineapple.
Right.
So we started going. We had long hair, beards, you know, nobody looked like we looked.
Yeah.
Right? Like I said, I'd been off. I didn't have to work for almost a year and a half.
Yeah.
All I did was read.
Yeah.
I was still going on a train.
Yeah.
Right?
How often were you training at that time?
Maybe 2 or 3 days a week.
Yeah.
Just go down to fight some guys, you know.
Yeah, that's what I realized with martial arts. If you want longevity in the thing, you know, you'll have different times when you'll train every day, and then you'll have times when you'll train twice a week, and then you'll get back into it. Yeah. You know,
so that's highs and lows.
Yeah,
but there again, you know, you got to entertain life, your responsibilities, your businesses, and this and that. So no one proselytized anything. We went, it's called satsang. We listened. But when I heard Kripal speaking in English on a tape, my soul knew that I found a way to God realization.
Right.
We didn't know nothing about getting initiated, vegetarian diet. That all came slowly as we kept going. Then, after the third time, I went to my father's house. I says, Pop, I think I found a master. Because the priest told him that masters were in the world. They were never without. There's never a time when a perfect living manifested Christ power was not in the world.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Not to step on anybody's theological toes.
No, yeah.
But then we knew that he was coming.
What did your dad say? I just think if I said that to my dad, he'd...
He waited all his life.
That's amazing. So your dad was like, he was on board.
Yeah.
Wow.
At our table on Sundays, my father taught us about reincarnation, karma, the lower ego, the senses.
And this is before all that. I mean, now it's like, you know, whatever. You can find a shirt, T-shirt that says, you know, karma on it or whatever.
Yeah.
But this was before that.
Yeah. But I still lived a young life, you know, a life of the senses. And don't forget, I lived in Japan. I lived with a girl there for 4 years, 3.5 years. But...
And you're 75 now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then the girl I was dating was raised in the Episcopal Church. So she thought me and my friend were off the wall looking for some path to enlightenment. But I said, wait till I show her this ad. That night she came by. She said, yeah, I know that church. We interacted with them. And she started coming.
Wow.
We went 3 times a week for a year preparing for Kripal Singh to come to this country in September of 1972.
Wow.
I met him on a farm in Virginia.
So when you say preparing, what does that mean? Like
learning about the teachings.
Yeah.
The difference between the mind, the soul, the senses.
Yeah.
The Surat Shabd Yoga. Surat means attention. The Shabd is the internal sound current the master connects you with. You can hear it. The efficacy of a master is his ability to make you see in the light and hear in the sound. And then he makes Jesus and all other masters, esoteric meanings of their words come alive.
Right.
Like Christ says, let thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. How do you make your eye single? Shut the flesh eyes. Then he says, the light shines in the darkness knows it not. A billion Christians don't know where the darkness is.
Right.
It's in the forehead.
Right.
There's something else that's seeing darkness when you close your eyes.
Which is?
Your soul.
Ah.
So you learn the difference between mind, body, soul, the 5 outgoing senses, and the 5 inner enemies of the soul.
Which are?
Anger. Gross lust, greed, attachment, and ego, the last nail in the coffin. And the only way to lose your ego is when you develop so much love for the master that initiates you.
Yeah.
The ego dissolves because it's all him. I don't want to get too deep on that.
Yeah.
So the Surat Shabd Yoga is the yoga of the attention, and he gives us a 5 charged mantra that's magnetically charged with his years and years of meditation and also from his master's years of meditation. And you learn to repeat this with the second tongue, the tongue of thought, the tongue you think with. Like counting 1 to 20 with your mind.
Right.
Every time your mind jumps off the count, start over.
Right.
Welcome to the mind.
So if you go to India, is this group still around?
Yeah, there's a living master in Bombay, Ram Singh.
And
they all earn their living themselves. They do not live off of donations.
Right.
You can weed out 99 9/10 of these spiritual teachers, priests, rabbis, mullahs, you name it. They're living off the donations.
Yeah.
Kirpal Singh, 36 years, deputy minister of accounts in the Indian government.
Wow.
He had 100 accountants under him.
Yeah.
His master was an engineer in the military.
Yeah, then you're not bound to, your morals can never be corrupted because you're never
no,
doing
they
it
don't
for
take
any
a dime. Yeah. They live on their own earnings. So Kirpal's successor, Ajaib Singh, earned his living as a farmer at his ashram, self-contained ashram. I met him 8 2-week periods when he came to this country, and he initiated 4 of my sons into the inner light and sound current.
Wow.
That sound current in the Christian Bible is called the Word.
Right.
In the beginning was the Word. The problem is it's called W-O-R-D, and it got interpreted as printed words and spoken words.
Right.
Printed words and spoken words did not create the creation.
Right.
The Greeks called it the music of the spheres.
Music of the spheres, that sounds lovely.
The Muslim mystics call it the unstruck sound. In the Buddha sutras, it's called the lion's roar.
Hmm.
I'll just share one more story on mystic teachings. So 500 years before the advent of Jesus, who became the Christ, it's like Gautama, who became the Buddha.
Yeah.
Okay. So Gautama was raised as a prince. His father was a king, and the father kept him away from the hardships of the world until he saw it.
Yeah.
Blindness, people being cremated at different ages, and it shook him to the root.
This is the story of Buddha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he got initiated. He hooked up with these wandering monks and got initiated into the inner light and sound.
Yeah.
So he made this resolve. He sat under the Bo tree in India for 6 years, day in and day out, until his enlightenment happened. So the dot on the meditating Buddha's forehead, everybody's got a Buddha statue somewhere.
Right.
You see the dot?
Yeah.
That is the same single eye that Jesus spoke of 500 years later. And the statue, and I've been to the Kamakura giant Buddha and the one in Honolulu, the Buddha's temple. They come, they bow, they put a dollar in a thing. They're wasting their time bowing to the statue.
Right.
The statue's telling them to sit in meditation.
Yeah.
And the dot is the single eye. So then you start, when you read the books of Kirpal Singh, he starts making the esoteric meaning of the words of the masters come alive. Not exoteric. Exoteric would be if I was born, I went to Catholic school, Roman Catholic Church, for 3 years in Brooklyn. My father pulled me out. They're lighting candles, ringing bells.
Yeah.
Rites and rituals.
Yeah.
Take communion, the body of Christ. You drink wine, the blood of Christ. What is that? There's old symbolism.
Yeah.
They don't even know what the real meaning of it was. The inner, the ringing bells and lighting candles is symbolic of the inner light and sound that is in the man body.
Right.
Which is the temple of God.
Right.
So all our heritage is to become enlightened. And if your good karma from past lifetimes brings you to meet a living master in your lifetime, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's not a belief. A belief is the biggest illusionary, meaningless word there is. Because a belief is someone else's story.
Yeah.
Okay. But he used to say, the religions are all flowers in God's garden. Therefore, the beginners, the Christianity and the various religions help civilize man.
They're flowers in the garden.
Right, they're because there was a time.
Flowers. That's a beautiful saying.
There was a time in this world, at any given time, every day you went out, you might have had a fight for your life.
Yeah.
Look at these idiots in the West shooting each other.
Right.
In Japan, the samurais, they were cutting, killing each other. Every day people were getting killed.
Yeah.
Throughout history, religions separated man and caused wars.
Right.
So, there's no religion higher than love for the creation, love for all. Kindness. Think universally. Peace be unto all the world over. You go outside, you don't want to look on the ground so you don't step on an ant.
Yeah.
So, in my case, it's like I'm working on myself. It's 45 years, but my mind behaves now, you know. I get up at 3 in the morning, I sit. And I do my practice. I go, when I get enough of the world, about every 3 months, I'll go up for a weekend to an ashram in Vermont. There's a meditation cave with a fireplace, and you want to sit in silence, and you can hear the sound over your head.
Do you think that your connection with spirituality changed your judo practice at all?
No, the judo practice led me to that.
The judo practice led you to that.
Yeah, because when you're in a dojo, you're training the mind. You think the mind wants to be there, getting slammed and strangled and arm locked?
Yeah.
So it tempers you.
There's one thing that I've seen with jiu-jitsu and judo to me are so similar. One's just standing, the other's on the ground. It's the mindset is very similar. The training is very similar.
Yeah, it depends. There's, if you got good teachers and you train hard and you're playing with skillful people.
But I've never encountered other martial arts that are similar to judo and jiu-jitsu, and the fact that the training is designed to be where you can train hard. You can go for your thing. And at the end of the training session, walk away, and everybody's healthy for the most part.
Absolutely, especially in judo. No one's hurt. With my friend Okahara, who became my training mate, I'm still friends with him. He lives in Indonesia now. After a 3-hour workout, I would take 75 falls for him.
Yeah.
Then he'd take 75 for me.
Yeah.
Then we went down and showered.
Right. Wow.
Repetition, repetition. That's when I developed a judo mate, where you can have it with you 24/7 and punch out your reps every day. People go to a dojo two, three times a week for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You train in Japan 6 days a week. 1 year of training over there is like 5 years of training here.
Right.
Whatever it is you want to do in this life, do it 3 hours a day. Whether you're playing an instrument, whether you're playing a sport.
Yeah.
The Olympians train 2 3-hour periods a day.
Right.
Then you'll excel. You put 3 hours a day in on a guitar, a flute.
Yeah.
Jiu-jitsu, judo. So as you think, so you become.
It's amazing. Me and Seamus, we get together, well, obviously with you on Thursdays, but then we do it on Sunday as well. Saturday and Sunday, we do our Randori together, and we practice Uchikomi, the reps. And I just now felt when you say, make you and your opponent one and throw by leaning.
Right.
And that, like I've heard you say it so many times that it's become kind of a mantra in my head.
Right.
That, but
you
when
pull
you
him into your chest and lean out and
right.
lift.
Right. But, like, and you'd say, bring the nipple to the armpit, bring the nipple to the armpit. And I, And
no, bring the armpit
to the nipple. Right?
Never does the nipple go to the armpit. Because right. That's how you're breaking the balance for Kazushi.
Right. But in my head, it finally made sense as I was doing it. As I was going through the motion, I could feel the pull and the break and the lean and the, and it was just, but in the beginning, your mind almost can't put all those pieces together.
So then it becomes experiential.
Training the mind, yeah.
It's the same thing in meditation. When you rise above body consciousness inside, you realize you're not the body. So that's the difference between a belief and something experiential.
Yes.
What I went back when I talked earlier about a belief.
Well, we'll stop here. Okay. We'll stop here. That's good.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was great.